Carrie could not say. Part of her worried he'd never come back home. Another part worried that he would. Carrie's distraught parents had left the house before she did, to continue to look for their son. However, Adam was not Howard and Irene's only concern. Her parents had thought her return to work was too much, too soon. But Carrie had insisted. After all, the man the police believed to be an emotionally unstable, well-armed stalker was dead. While Carrie sounded convincing, the reality was a far cry from her assurances. The drive to the VA proved tense, as Carrie remained on high alert. Until Goodwin and Trent were decommissioned, she remained a target, and certainly DARPA had more deadly resources to throw at her. So long as she kept with the crowds, on the roads, or in the halls of the VA, however, Carrie felt moderately safe. What she would not do, misguided or not, was cower, go into hiding, or hire an armed detail to guard her 24/7. She had to live her life, terror be damned. Bottom line, she was on a mission. Her voicemail and email were flooded with messages from concerned friends and former colleagues, many of whom had heard about Carrie's ordeal on the local news. Dr. Finley had called, but she let it go to voicemail, too. He'd side with her mother and insist Carrie rest at home for the day. Among those checking in was Carrie's old pal Valerie from BCH, who called during the morning commute. Their conversation was brief, but Val's worry touched Carrie's heart. The former colleagues made plans to get together for drinks and dinner in the coming weeks. "You have no idea who that man was?" Val asked. "Police are still looking. They think they'll get an ID soon, though." "Well, I'm just grateful you're all right. And I want you to know, Carrie, that you're deeply missed around here. I mean that." Carrie's eyes welled, but she did not cry. No need to make Val feel worse. "I'm doing okay," she said. "I mean it." Val, being Val, said, "You got somebody to talk to?" "Like a therapist?" Carrie asked. "Well, not exactly," Val said. "Oh, that," Carrie said. "Just saying, it would help." Carrie laughed. "Yeah, I've got someone to talk to." "Well, I want to hear all about him." "Who said it's a he?" Val scoffed. "It could be a woman. Don't matter to me. But I am pretty sure we're not talking about a stuffed animal here, darling. You can give me all the 411 when I see you. And take care of yourself, Carrie. I mean it." "I will." As she hung up with Val, the car in front, no signal given, abruptly changed lanes. Carrie had to hit the brakes hard to avoid a collision. She hit her horn and muttered a string of expletives that would have had her mother blush first and cringe second. The other driver's maneuver was not unusual during rush hour, and Carrie's outburst surprised her. Stress-induced, she figured, and in that moment she forgave Adam for everything. Her brother's anger, directed toward her and at David, was triggered by constant duress. In the aftermath of her own extreme stress, Carrie could better relate to Adam's persistent volatility. She called her parents to check on the search and was told that they had been unable to locate Adam. They would resume the effort later, after they returned home from work. Carrie had her doubts they would have any success. Something about Adam's last tirade made Carrie believe she would never see her brother again. She remained extra vigilant as she navigated through the crush of morning traffic. At one point, she glanced in her rearview mirror and noticed a red Camaro a few cars back that looked a lot like Adam's. Of course, that was impossible. If Adam had gotten that car fired up, they'd have seen a celebration worthy of Mardi Gras on his side of the garage. Curious, though, Carrie tried to get a look at the driver, but the car was too far back for her to see much of anything. Frustrated with the pace of her commute, Carrie took the next exit, not her usual. A short time later, the Camaro reappeared in her rearview. Carrie relived the sinking feeling she'd had in the park when her future would-be murderer became something to fear. A block later, though, the Camaro turned down a side street. Just like that, it was gone. The uneasy feelings, the fear and paranoia, a sense that something horrible could happen any minute, a terror that pawed at the back of her neck. Those feelings lasted all the way to the VA and followed her into the building. Carrie braced herself for an onslaught of attention that did not come. Even in the busy main foyer, nobody took notice of her. In a way, the silence was a stark reminder of her low profile at the hospital. While her face had been splashed all over the TV, she was not a well-known figure here. Her role fit in that netherworld between employee and contractor. At the main entrance, Carrie flashed her ID to the security guard and walked in without fanfare. Welcome back to the jungle. Nice of you to come. The morning hustle and bustle seemed so perfectly ordinary, which paradoxically made it all feel a little eerie. Although there was a heavier-than-usual VA police presence, Carrie saw no crime scene tape, nothing cordoned off. The evidence, as Dr. Kowalski indicated, had been gathered, documented, and photographed in the intervening hours. Life at the VA, for all intents and purposes, had returned to normal. Carrie's plan for the day was a simple one. With no surgery on the docket, she would spend time examining Dr. Finley's case files and start to gather evidence. David had the right instincts. Had other vets gone MIA, like Abington and Fasciani? If Goodwin wanted to conceal a side effect such as palynacusis, the first step would be to get those patients off the neuro recovery floor, where residents were trained to look for cognitive issues. Carrie showed up at Dr. Finley's office with two cups of coffee, but when she opened the closed door, she found three people inside. Sandra Goodwin and Evan Navarro sat on those uncomfortable metal chairs facing Dr. Finley. Carrie's eyes turned to slits as she focused her attention on Goodwin. She fought back the urge to scream, "Did you try to have me killed?" The outburst might have been satisfying, but Carrie knew it would serve no purpose. All that mattered was obtaining proof of Goodwin's wrongdoing. That required tact, not brute force. Goodwin and Navarro both acted irritated by Carrie's intrusion. No outward signs of empathy there. Dr. Finley's face, by contrast, revealed his deep concern, and it put a walnut-sized lump in Carrie's throat. He was effusive in expressing his utter relief. Carrie presented Dr. Finley with the coffee she'd brought him. "I know it's not Starbucks, but it's the best we've got here," she said. "The fact that you could think about me at all is incredible," Dr. Finley said. He took the beverage with a grateful smile. He remained standing beside Carrie, his hire. Carrie looked over at Goodwin and Navarro. "I hope I'm not interrupting anything," she said. "Coincidentally enough," Goodwin said, "you were the subject of our conversation." The tone of her voice cooled the room a few degrees. "Oh? We're discussing the DBS program," Navarro said. Carrie could not help feeling amazed at the lack of empathy. "Well, in case you or Sandra were curious, I'm doing just fine," she said. "Thank you very much for asking." "I'm glad to hear it," Goodwin said, not sounding glad at all. "But my chief concern, as I was just explaining to Alistair, is the continuation of DBS surgeries in light of your incident." "By incident, I assume you mean my attempted murder." Carrie felt her whole body heat up. It took great restraint not to go at Goodwin the way Adam had threatened David. "It's my opinion that a trauma such as what you experienced makes you a danger to the patients and to the program." "Last I checked, I wasn't actually shot," Carrie countered. She saw where this conversation was headed, and she did not like it one bit. "While you aren't physically injured," Goodwin said, "your mental status is questionable at best. Evan has been studying up on the DBS procedure, and I think he'll be fine to take over for you until a mental health professional clears you to operate." "Evan?" Carrie could not hide her incredulity. "Is that why he came to the OR to watch me work? Nice bit of subterfuge there, Sandra. Well played."
"I don't appreciate your innuendos, Carrie," Navarro said.
"I don't appreciate you poaching my job," Carrie snapped back.
"It would only be temporary," Dr. Finley said in a conciliatory tone.
Carrie frowned. "You're not on their side here, are you, Alistair?"
"No," Dr. Finley said. "I'm not. But we have another problem."
Sandra flashed a frigid smile.
"I told Alistair that if we don't replace you with Evan, I'll go to the board with a formal complaint about your violating my procedures by interfering with patient care. Given all the scrutiny the VA is under these days, I'm sure you can imagine how poorly that will be received." "They'll force me to let you go, Carrie," Dr. Finley said in a defeated voice. "And Evan will continue in your place regardless, so really, Carrie, you have no choice in the matter."
"When is the next surgery?" Carrie asked.
"The day after tomorrow," Navarro said.
Carrie shot Dr. Finley a panicked look. "Is it a PTSD case?" she asked.
"Yes, it is," Navarro answered. "But don't worry, I'm ready, and it'll go just fine."
Dr. Finley cleared his throat, and Carrie noticed how uncomfortable he seemed.
"Carrie, Dr. Goodwin has requested that you take a leave of absence until you're medically cleared to operate." I've seen how you like to interfere with my processes and procedures. I'm not one to give second chances, and I don't want to risk you inserting yourself where your services are not required.
Alistair, I can't believe you're letting this happen, Carrie said. Navarro doesn't know anything about DBS.
Look at it this way, Carrie, Dr. Finley said. I have no choice. That's the way it is in the VA. It's the military, and everyone has to take orders, including me. Navarro has a licensed MD after his name, and as far as the VA is concerned, that means he can do everything from heart surgery to delivering a baby if the VA says so.
I strongly disagree with this, Carrie said. How can you feel comfortable with someone who may be completely incompetent?
As I recall, Carrie, Navarro said, you had no experience when you came on board. If you take some time away, I can get you back on the team, Dr. Finley said, on a permanent basis, if you like. If you don't, Sandra will go to the board, and if she does that, your status here will be entirely out of my hands.
Carrie's arms fell to her sides. What choice do I have? She asked.
Goodwin stood. None, she said.
Chapter 53.
With a scowl across her face, Carrie leaned against a wall outside Dr. Finley's office, arms folded tightly across her chest, and waited for Goodwin and Navarro to depart. As he walked out, Navarro shot Carrie a smarmy, sidelong glance that made her blood boil once more. But her real anger was saved for Goodwin, who refused to look Carrie in the eyes.
Are you surprised I'm still alive? Carrie wanted to shout.
Goodwin could not have been completely dissatisfied, though. She had played the same blackmail card twice, but this time to greater effect. Carrie stormed back into Dr. Finley's office as soon as the other two were out of sight.
I can't believe you let Goodwin do that to me, Carrie snapped as she closed the door behind her.
Seated at his desk, Dr. Finley looked utterly besieged. He let go a loud sigh and ran his fingers through an unruly tangle of hair. We can retreat now and regroup later, or Goodwin will put a permanent end to your career, he said. She'll trash your reputation so that you'll never match for another residency, and I doubt you'll find a situation like this one at some other hospital. Think about what's best for your career here, Carrie. Take the time off. Let the dust settle and hope to allow cooler heads to prevail. The program has to be protected at all costs.
Though it stung to hear, Carrie was not entirely surprised by Dr. Finley's stance. Any threat to the program, in his view, had to be neutralized.
He had gone out of his way to hire Carrie in a rather unorthodox manner to avoid significant delays following Rockwell's accident. He would do what was necessary to keep the OR active.
Speaking of the program, did you know Bob Richardson works for CerebroMed?
Dr. Finley's brow creased and he looked a little puzzled. I've never met Richardson before your demo, but I'm not entirely surprised.
No? Why?
DARPA hired them.
DARPA contracted with CerebroMed? Carrie was surprised. We deal in DBS, Alistair, not neurological drugs.
I'm well aware, Dr. Finley said. Caltran told me that CerebroMed has been developing software for studying and recreating traumatic events. DARPA has been partnering with them, but that's all I know. It's part of the VR program and not really within my area of expertise. How did you learn this, by the way?
Carrie shrugged off the question. There was no use debating. Carrie knew she had lost her greatest ally. This program was Dr. Finley's greatest love, and it meant more to him than the truth about Goodwin. That much was obvious. Until she could give him definitive proof, he would always find a logical explanation for any concern Carrie raised.
Well, can I at least review the files I requested? Carrie asked. Yes, of course, Dr. Finley said, and he presented Carrie with a large stack of files.
Carrie glanced at them briefly. These are neurological reports, she said.
Yes.
I'm looking specifically for postoperative complications.
Dr. Finley grimaced a little. I'm afraid that would require Dr. Goodwin's involvement.
Carrie just smiled and clutched Dr. Finley's files to her chest.
No worries, then, she said.
I'll just look over what I have. Carrie retreated to her office. She set Dr. Finley's files on her desk. From her purse, she dug out Evan Navarro's hospital ID and logon credentials. They were written on the same piece of scratch paper as the main number for the VA, which Carrie had jotted down the night Eric Fasciani disappeared. Carrie might not be able to view the medical records of DBS patients who had spent time on the neuro recovery floor, but Navarro could.
The Electronic Medical Record System, known as VISTA, for Veterans Health Information Systems and Technology Architecture, offered a variety of specialized enterprise applications, including electronic health records. The system, one of the largest in the United States, contained the records of more than 8 million veterans and personal data for hundreds of thousands of medical personnel and operating staff. Carrie was interested in only a handful of patients, specifically vets like Abington and Fasciani, who had DBS surgery to combat PTSD symptoms. Carrie launched the VISTA program and entered Navarro's ID into the logon screen. It took her almost 30 minutes to figure out the system, but eventually Carrie got the hang of it. It was different from the electronic medical records system at BCH, but intuitive enough for her to search for Steve Abington's name. From there, Carrie was a few clicks away from the problem list detailed in the computerized patient record system, abbreviated on the graphical user interface as CPRS. Steve Abington's arrhythmia was logged as inactive, but she could see the onset date, last update, and location of the incident, which was the neuro recovery floor. The application said nothing about Abington's transfer to the med ICU, probably because Navarro did not have access privileges to that part of his medical record. Navarro was a neurosurgeon, and it seemed the walls Goodwin had erected between her department and the rest of the VA applied to this software application as well. No matter. Using Abington's case file, Carrie retrieved the clinic-specific procedure code for DBS and used that to search all DBS patients in the past 12 months. There they were. Some names Carrie recognized: Steve Abington, Eric Fasciani, Don McCall, Ramon Hernandez, Gerald Wright, and Terry Bushman. Some she did not. Based on the patients who were fully anesthetized during their operation, it was easy to distinguish between DBS patients treated for movement disorders and those treated for PTSD. On a piece of paper, Carrie made a two-column table and filled it with information from Abington's patient record. She ignored details such as clinical reminders, recent lab results, patient record flags, postings, and active medications to focus solely on significant problems that might have resulted in a patient being transferred to another unit. She started with the patients she knew, and in a matter of minutes had a list of four names, with one medical complication post-DBS among them. Patient name, Abington, Steve. Problem list, ventricular tachycardia. Patient name, Hernandez, Ramon. Problem list, none. Patient name, Fasciani, Eric. Problem list, none. Patient name, Bushman, Terry. Problem list, none. The next patient Carrie looked up was Jim Caldwell. According to the record, Sam Rockwell had done his surgery. 7 hours after the operation, Caldwell's blood sugar levels dropped. Carrie could not see in the VISTA system whether he remained on the neuro recovery floor, but now she had another name for her expanding table. Patient name Caldwell, Jim. Problem list, hypoglycemia. This process went on for several hours. Carrie combed through the records of every vet who had come through the DARPA program seeking a cure for PTSD. 20 names in total. By this point, Carrie's eyes were like sandpaper. But her mind was reeling, and her whole body pulsed with an intense energy like nothing she'd ever experienced. She scanned the list, utterly incredulous. Of the 20 patients in total, 15 had experienced complications, 11 of which were not typically associated with the surgery. Carrie made a second table that summarized her findings. Complication, arrhythmia, number of instances, 4. Complication, hypoglycemia, number of instances, 3. Complication, hypotension, number of instances, 4. Complication, severe nausea, number of instances, 2. Complication, vision problems / NOS, number of instances, 2. Complication, no complications, number of instances, 5. Once again, Navarro's access restrictions prevented Carrie from seeing what happened to each patient following his medical complication, but she presumed many would have been transferred to the med ICU or some other acute care department within the hospital. Carrie was not certain of the percent of DBS surgeries that resulted in post-op complications, but she knew the number was not 75%. It would be Goodwin's job to bring these astronomical numbers to Dr. Finley's attention, which, of course, she would not do if her intent was to hide them. With Goodwin's philosophy of turfing so ingrained, by getting the patients off the floor, she essentially made them disappear. Carrie tried to come up with ways those complications could be induced. Potassium certainly could produce arrhythmia, and insulin obviously made the blood sugar levels drop. Beta blockers were a possible cause for a sudden drop in blood pressure, but Carrie knew of several drugs that would induce hypotension. 5 patients appeared to have no postoperative side effects whatsoever, but that included Eric Fasciani, who had improbably overcome the effects of Valium to check out AMA. 2 of the other 5 vets Carrie knew, Ramon Hernandez and Terry Bushman. The remaining 2 must have been the patients Dr. Finley said had results similar to Bushman and Hernandez. Carrie thought back to the night Fasciani disappeared and recalled that only 1 nurse was working the floor, the same man she thought she'd recognized in the photograph at Rita Abington's home. If Nurse Taggart were involved, Fasciani could have been removed from the floor without intentionally inducing some medical complication. Carrie took out her phone to call David and tried to quell the intense feelings of anger that coursed through her veins. David picked up on the second ring. "Do you still have the temporary ID for Michael Stephen?" she asked.
"And hello to you too, my dear," David said in a cheery voice. "I've been worried about you all day. How are you?"
"No time to chat. I need to know if you still have that ID."
"I've still got it," David said. "Why?"
"Because I'm now persona non grata on the neuro recovery floor and in the VA as well, but you're not."
"And what, pray tell, will I be doing on the neuro recovery floor?"
"You'll be helping me figure out what really happens to Evan Navarro's very first DBS patient after his surgery is done." Chapter 54. David's temporary ID was good for the month, and he had no trouble getting inside the VA. He wore his easy-on, easy-off disguise, surgical scrubs, and canvas sneakers, and just like that, he was one of the crew. By now, he guessed, Carrie was parked in the back lot, watching the rear of the building. David flashed on his meeting with Carrie just hours ago at Java du Jour. While it had only been a day since he'd last seen her, his visit marred by that uncomfortable confrontation with Adam, David felt as if it had been weeks. He took in every detail of her, and even though she was grim-faced and tense, David felt exhilarated to be with her again. They ordered cappuccinos and discussed the plan. Just like the last time, their drinks went cold. Carrie might have lost access to the OR, but she could still read the surgical schedule. From that, she got the name of Navarro's first DBS patient, Garrett McGee. It was David who had come up with the stakeout approach. It made sense to Carrie because she did not know what happened to the patients after they left the neuro recovery floor. Were they even moved to a different unit? "I think they get transferred," Carrie had said. "Dr. Finley showed me Abington's patient information from the med ICU.
David was not convinced. "But that was after you went there looking for him," he said.
"So?"
"Maybe he never even made it there," David said.
"Come to think of it, the nurse in the med ICU couldn't trace him when I showed up, but I thought that was some problem with the record system. Should we set up surveillance cameras in McGee's hospital room?"
David shook his head. "Might be easy to detect. I think we should figure out what happens, if anything happens, see it for ourselves, and then we'll improvise how to get the proof we need."
Carrie clutched her arms tightly, as though staving off a sudden chill. "These are killers, David," Carrie said. "I feel sick, I'm so scared. I don't know if I can go through with this."
"I'm just as scared as you are," David said. "And I'll back out, but only if you want to."
It was obvious from Carrie's face that it was not an option. "I've never wanted to be more wrong about something in my entire life," Carrie said.
"Stats don't lie," David said. "Based on what you found, we have a 75% chance of proving that you're right."
David wandered the halls of the VA, trying to look like he belonged. He made frequent visits to the cafeteria and the restroom to pass the time until the next shift change. Throughout it all, he remained in constant communication with Carrie using Motorola two-way radios, which she had bought at Walmart for $60. Now, 30 minutes before showtime, David had Carrie on his mind as much as the mission. He snuck into an unoccupied, quiet room and put the push-to-talk to his mouth.
"Ground control to Major Tom. Can you hear me, Major Tom?"
There was a crackle, and he heard Carrie's voice say, "Not funny."
"It was a little funny," David said.
"What's going on? Where are you?"
"Shift change is happening soon. I'm getting ready to move into position. I just wanted to hear your voice before I headed out."
"Be careful, David,"
Carrie said. I don't know what's going to happen.
Careful is my middle name, David said.
I thought you told me it was Charles.
David's eyes widened. Wow, that's some steel trap memory you've got there.
He imagined Carrie's smile, and it filled him with joy. Just be careful, she repeated. Radio me when you're in position.
At 15 minutes before the hour, David headed for the neuro recovery floor. According to Carrie's intel, the unit was already half full with non-DBS surgical patients, but Garrett McGee was not scheduled to arrive for several more hours. At that moment, Navarro was still doing the job Carrie had done, and Dr. Finley was in the OR with him, guiding his every step. The double doors to the unit were closed and locked when David arrived, but he did not want to be buzzed inside. Instead, he used his smartphone to look occupied as he waited for the next shift to show up. There would be a little commotion at that point, during which David could more easily slip inside undetected. At 5 minutes until 3 o'clock, the new crew emerged from the elevator in a clump, chatting noisily amongst each other. The unit doors buzzed open, and David fell into step right behind them. He walked purposefully down the hall. He was practiced at looking official in places where he did not belong, and from the corner of his eyes, it did not appear anybody paid particularly close attention to him. He was quick to locate the room with McGee's name written on a whiteboard, the kind of reservation nobody wanted to have. Inside the cubicle space, David found an adjustable hospital bed, along with a bunch of medical equipment he could not identify. The glass enclosure left David exposed, but at least there were no direct sight lines to the nurse's station. As a precaution, David closed the flimsy curtain for privacy and slipped inside the freestanding wardrobe closet that was pushed up against the wall opposite the bed. He closed the doors and plunged into darkness. A thin crack between the closet doors offered some light, but not much. He had hardly any space to move about, and David already dreaded the many hours he would spend inside waiting for Garrett McGee's arrival. After 5 minutes or so, David's legs began to throb, so he removed the two-way from his pants pocket, twisted his body so his back pressed against one of the side walls, and sank to the closet floor. To fit better, David wrapped his arms around his knees, which were nearly in his mouth, but at least he could hold this position for a while, meditate, if he had to. He put the two-way to his mouth and called Carrie. I'm in a closet on the neuro recovery floor, he said. He had the volume low for when Carrie answered back.
Okay, I'm outside watching the back entrance. I'll wait to hear from you.
Roger, over and out, or whatever you're supposed to say.
There was a brief period of silence during which David wished he had one more chance to hear Carrie's voice. A second later, the radio crackled back to life. Thank you, David. I mean it. Thank you for everything.
Roger, over and out, David said.
And that was enough for him. Tedium.
The walls of David's hideout were made of thin particle board, so he passed the time by listening to the nurse's chatter, or counting the beeps on whichever machine happened to be loudest. The antiseptic hospital smell, that sickly clean odor, was starting to get to him, making the hours even more unpleasant to endure. Adding to his discomfort, David's body heat had turned the cramped quarters oppressively stuffy, and the slat between the doors offered a limited supply of fresh air. He had checked in with Carrie about a dozen times, but now he had to go dark since McGee could arrive at any minute. David's phone battery had run down, but he guessed it was close to 7 p.m., going by the last time he spoke with Carrie. 4 hours jammed like a pretzel inside a closet. This was becoming a habit for him, it seemed. He felt achy all over, and the throbbing pain in his knees had gone from uncomfortable to deeply unpleasant. He could stretch his arms above his head, and that lessened the soreness somewhat. He wondered when, if, McGee would finally show up. The minutes passed slowly and without mercy until maybe another hour had ticked off the clock. What if there were complications? What if McGee died during surgery? Maybe Navarro was as incompetent as he was devious. At some point during the long stretch of time with nothing happening, David felt pressure building in his bladder. Oh, great, he muttered. I can hold it, was his first thought. McGee better get here soon, was the next thing to cross his mind. A minute passed, then another, and all David could think about was peeing. When the pressure finally got too intense, David pushed open the closet door and clambered out like the Tin Man before he got oiled.
The curtain kept David mostly out of sight while he used a portable urinal to relieve himself. The overwhelming feeling of relief extended to his arms and legs, and David absolutely despised the thought of jamming himself back into the wardrobe. But then he heard the squeaky wheels of a stretcher in motion. David scrambled into the closet and got the doors closed a few seconds before the stretcher came rolling into the room. The portable toilet was a tight fit under his legs, but he could not leave it half full of his urine for the nurses to find. There was a lot of commotion and dialogue as the patient, who David presumed was McGee, was transferred from the stretcher to the bed. Two nurses took their time getting McGee's vitals and hooking up his IV. Now began the waiting game, and with each passing minute, each agonizing hour, David grew more weary. If nothing happened, and statistically that was a 25% possibility, he would find a way to sneak out of McGee's room and get back to Carrie. Mission aborted for the night. His thoughts were dulled from inactivity and waiting. The nurses came and went. They chatted playfully amongst themselves, but it was obvious they had tremendous confidence in their craft and deep caring for the patients. David was not interested in evaluating their skills as nursing professionals. He was waiting for the complication. It must have been 11 because another shift change arrived. He heard them talking, discussing medications, treatment, and such. A doctor poked her head in and did some exam on McGee, but it was brief. 30 minutes after the 11 o'clock shift change took place, it had to be 30, David heard someone enter the room. That was odd because the new duty nurse had been in to see McGee not long ago. The muscles in the back of David's neck tightened to the point he thought they might snap, but he turned his head anyway to get a look out the crack in the closet door. He could see a shape, the outline of a man with dark skin, lurking over McGee's bed. "How are we feeling tonight, Garrett?" the male nurse asked while glancing at a clipboard. David watched the nurse extract something from the pocket of his uniform and had to squint to make out the syringe in the nurse's hand. The nurse inserted the syringe into the IV. Nothing happened for several minutes until the nurse said, "Open your eyes, Garrett. The drug I gave you should make you less groggy." "Good, that's real good. Can you hear my voice?" McGee groaned and then said in a mumbling voice with almost exaggerated torpidity, "Yeah, yes, stop saying it. Stop it." "Oh, good," the nurse said. "I'm going to give you a little something else." "A little something else, a little something else, a little something." McGee spoke as though in a daze, but he pronounced the words clearly so they were easy to understand. David thought immediately of the auditory illusion, palynacusis, Carrie had so accurately described. It sounded as though McGee was acting out her very description. Still, peering through that crack in the closet, David watched the nurse inject something else into McGee's IV. And a minute later, he took out a smartphone and made a call.
"Rear entrance, 20 minutes, the nurse said. "Keep the van running. It'll be quick."
David felt elated. At last, they had proof Carrie was right. Something truly sinister was going on here, even if he had no idea what exactly caused the auditory illusion, or where this nurse was taking McGee, or what would happen to him once he got there, or why they were doing it. Carrie was watching the rear entrance right now, and she needed to know trouble was headed her way. Chapter 55. Hours of doing nothing made it hard to ignore the ever-present fear. It also gave Carrie lots of idle time to think about Adam. Nobody had heard from him since he'd left in such a rage. Her parents naturally continued to worry and contemplated canceling evening plans to wait at home for him to show, but Carrie cajoled them into going out. If Adam was going to show, he would do so when he felt ready, she advised. So her parents went out, and soon after, Carrie did the same. Had Adam returned home, Carrie would not have known. She kept her phone in her purse and the radio off, worried she might miss something of consequence if distracted. But there was a whole lot of nothing going on, and this gave Carrie time to fret and ponder the mission's many open questions. Would McGee even have a medical complication induced? Would he be transferred to another unit or moved out of the hospital entirely? Would they bring him back? If so, when? The plan itself was all a bit squishy, as Carrie said to David, which ran counter to her ethos of procedures and planning.
Then again, she had long ago abandoned her comfort zone and proved to herself many times over just how adaptable she had become. For want of something to do, Carrie ran through the plan's many permutations in her mind for the umpteenth time. David was going to trail McGee off the unit floor, assuming he experienced some sort of medical problem that required transfer. If McGee left the hospital entirely, it would be Carrie's job to pick David up in her car, unless that maneuver would cause her to lose sight of the patient. For that reason, David had a zip car on standby in the visitor parking lot. If they became separated, she and David could communicate their locations via the two-way radios, which had a 35-mile range. That was the plan. Squishy. It had been hours since David made contact, and in that time, Carrie's concern had grown. Not to panic levels, but close. She knew McGee must have been on the neuro recovery unit for several hours by now, but how long it would be until somebody might try to sneak him off the floor was anybody's guess. The crackle of the radio sent Carrie's heart revving. She felt a surge of excitement, like the first tug on a once-slack fishing line. "Carrie, are you there?" David spoke in a hushed voice.
"I'm here. What's the status?"
"A male nurse just left McGee's hospital room. I think he injected something into his IV. It said something about a van coming to the rear entrance in about 20 minutes. Do you copy?"
Carrie scanned her surroundings. The rear entrance was in sight of where she was parked. "I got it. Where are you right now?" she asked.
That would be a closet in McGee's cubicle."
"David, you've got to get out of there."
"Well, that's my plan. I'll meet you at the rear entrance and we'll see if that van shows up."
In the background, Carrie heard loud beeping sounds. Right away, she understood that one of the machines hooked to McGee had just gone haywire. Another alarm sounded, this one much louder. "Oh no, David," Carrie said into the radio. "Get out of there. Get out right now." In a matter of seconds, McGee's cramped quarters had two nurses at his bedside. Through the slat between the closet doors, David watched them work as a team. McGee muttered under his breath,
"I feel dizzy, dizzy, dizzy."
After a minute or so of silence, one of the nurses said, "Blood pressure is 85 over 40, heart rate 120 BPM, respiratory 16 breaths."
"He feels clammy to me," the other nurse said.
"Shaking, sweating? Does he have diabetes?"
"Not according to the EMR.
Check his blood sugar anyway." From out of David's view, a new voice spoke up. It was the same person who had earlier injected McGee with something.
"What's happening?" the male nurse said. "I was just down the hall when I heard the alarm."
"Nurse Taggart, hello. I think our friend here might be having a blood sugar problem."
"Oh," was all Taggart said.
"I can give 2 milligrams IM glucagon," said one nurse. "And see what that does for him. I'd like a doctor to see him right away, please." David felt dizzy and sweaty. He could pretty much follow the procedures as they took place, and soon after McGee got the glucagon, a woman showed up, dark-skinned, thin, petite, and introduced herself as Dr. Nisha Kapoor. 50cc D50 stat, Dr. Kapoor said. "We treat him first, and then confirm with the lab results."
FS0, said a nurse. "I sent a venous level to the stat lab."
Dr. Kapoor performed a battery of tests on McGee just as David's left leg started to go numb. Prolonged pressure had cut off communication between the nerves in David's leg and his brain, producing an array of sensations that included warmth, numbness, and a wholly unpleasant tingling.
"How are you feeling, Mr. McGee?" Kapoor said in an overly loud voice.
"How are you feeling? How are you feeling? How are you feeling? Stop asking me."
Sounds of flailing and twisting limbs alerted David that McGee was likely quite agitated and might need to be restrained.
"He's a bit delirious from the DBS surgery still," one nurse said.
Somebody else entered the room. "What's going on?"
"Oh, Dr. Goodwin," Dr. Kapoor said. "I didn't know you were here."
"Well, I'm helping out Evan because he was doing DBS surgery today." Dr. Kapoor explained the situation to Dr. Goodwin.
"Don't you think we should transfer him to the med ICU?
"I can do that," Nurse Taggart said. "It's not a problem."
"Great, thanks, and I'll head down to alert them that he's on his way," Goodwin said as she rushed out of the room. While this took place, David's leg became miserably numb. The feeling of pins and needles digging into his skin was agonizing in ways he had never experienced. He tried everything to stretch the leg, but the burning sensation only intensified. David watched the nurses unhook the monitors, and soon enough, Nurse Taggart wheeled Garrett McGee out of the room.
The two nurses who stayed behind set to work putting the cubicle back together, which was now down one bed. Massaging his leg, David tried to ease the torturous sensation, but to no avail. He had to stretch the leg completely to get any relief, and every second the nurses remained inside the empty unit was excruciating. They chatted pleasantly, taking their sweet time. A minute passed. Then two. The leg had to move. David flexed his hips and lifted the leg up a few inches. The relief was not quite enough, but it was something. He raised the leg a little bit higher, but this time his right leg moved as well. As it did, he knocked over the portable toilet with his urine inside. The plastic container landed with a soft sound that might not have attracted any attention, but the top came open and the liquid spilled out. David watched in horror as his urine trickled out of the bottom of the closet door and cascaded to the floor like a golden waterfall. He could not move an inch to create a dam without pushing open the closet doors. It did not really matter. A few seconds of the River David was enough for a nurse to take notice. The closet door swung open with force, and David smiled awkwardly at the startled woman, who let fly a thunderous shriek. David wasted no time. He sprang from the closet like a jack-in-the-box cut loose from its spring. His right leg landed just fine, but with his left leg asleep, his foot buckled from what he hoped was a temporary paralysis. He nearly collapsed to the floor. The nurse closest to him stumbled back and screamed again. A look of shock stretched across her face. Both nurses were frozen in place, which gave David a head start to hop out of the room. He could feel the sensation in his foot slowly return through the pins and needles. The strength came back fully by the time he reached the stairwell. From behind, David heard tremendous tumult and commotion, but one phrase stuck out above all the others. "He took the stairs! Call the police!" David descended one level and went out the first exit he came to, entering the hallway directly below the neuro recovery unit. He tried the nearest door, but it was locked. Time was going to run out on him. He put the radio to his lips.
"Carrie, listen, abort, abort. I've been spotted. Do you hear me? Respond."
"David, what's going on?" David could not answer because footsteps like a stampede could be heard headed his way. Security was heightened in the aftermath of Carrie's lethal encounter, and David was not surprised by the speed and effectiveness of the response. He retreated back to the stairs, his only way out. The stairwell door boomed shut behind him. Breathless with anxiety, David shouted into the radio, "I've been spotted and they've called the police." His voice echoed in the stairwell. From below, David heard,
"You up there! Come down with your hands up!"
Nobody was going to wait for David to comply. Loud footsteps were on their way up to greet him. It would be a hell of an escape, but David was not ready to give up just yet. He left the stairwell for a second time and re-entered the hallway he had just exited. This time, two uniformed police officers were running his way. With no available options, David darted back into the stairwell where another police officer had just come into view.
Hands up," David heard.
The officer stood five stairs away and removed what looked like a gun from his holster. David had just put the radio to his lips when the officer flicked his wrist. A square-shaped cartridge spat out the front end of what David saw now was a taser.
"Carrie, abort!
A knife-like pain ripped through David's body the instant those contact points penetrated his right thigh. The pain was like nothing he had ever experienced. His skin felt on fire, immolation from the inside out. Maybe a scream escaped his lips, hard for him to say. His body vibrated so violently it threatened to break apart. Twitching, David fell to the concrete, landing hard on his back. Through the slits of his eyes, pushing beyond the pain, the burn, the earthquake of his body, David fixed his gaze on the radio that had tumbled from his grasp. He reached for it, but felt another pinch. A second lightning bolt of electricity coursed through him. His teeth knocked together in a violent chatter as his arms went spastic. The radio, his lifeline to carry, was within reach, but miles away. Chapter 15. On Wednesday afternoon, a week after her coffee with Dr. Finley, Carrie followed a group of doctors into the cramped VA hospital auditorium for the monthly Grand Rounds conference, which was usually a welcome break from the grind. This gathering hummed with extra excitement because Dr. Finley was expected to make a big announcement regarding the deep brain stimulation program.
The room was packed with neurosurgery, neurology, and psychiatry attending and resident physicians, as well as a number of other parties who were interested in hearing what Dr. Alistair Finley had to say about DBS. Dr. Finley, who'd been working at this VA for years, was considered a pioneer in applying the technique to a variety of brain and mental disorders. Perhaps that was why this GR was so well attended. Or maybe it was the free pizza. Carrie settled into one of the cushioned seats in the second row, where she had a good view of the rather small screen used for the PowerPoint projection. Most everyone was dressed in scrubs and white coats, except for two men Carrie had noticed in the back of the hall. One was bald, with close-set eyes and a round face. The other had a square head, broad shoulders, and a football player's neck. His stone-hard gaze held all the joy of a funeral, and Carrie got a shiver when they briefly locked eyes. For the past week, Carrie had been obsessively studying the software that did most of the heavy lifting in the OR. When it came to DBS procedures, precision, surgical skill, and patience were the chief operational skills required, and she would have to work as part of a team. It was painstaking, complicated work. A typical procedure could last 5 to 6 hours. That explained why nobody was available to assume Sam Rockwell's responsibilities. The entire Department of Neurology and Neurosurgery at the VA consisted of only 3 full-time physicians. 3. It was microscopic, even by BCH standards. Dr. Finley was the staff neurologist, and Dr. Sandra Goodwin and Dr. Evan Navarro comprised the surgical team. Dr. Goodwin, a severe-looking woman in her late 50s with a broad forehead and aquiline nose, was the head of the neurosurgery department and therefore perpetually bogged down with administrative work. As a result, most of the actual surgical responsibilities fell to the staff attending, Dr. Navarro. Dr. Navarro, a thin man with a small face, dark hair, and ferret eyes, was also in charge of the residents who rotated through the VA from satellite hospitals, much as Carrie had done at community. Carrie and Navarro had not quite hit it off. She found him cold and disinterested, a typical ego on legs. Goodwin was more affable, but harried by the constant demands on her time. The good news was that Carrie's involvement with Navarro would be limited. For the DBS program to flourish, Finley needed the dedication of one committed, exclusive neurosurgeon. That role would be Carrie's, her sole responsibility. At 5 minutes past the hour, Dr. Finley strode to the lectern and slipped on his half-moon reading glasses. His hair was tousled as usual, but with his starched long white lab coat, crisply pressed white shirt, and classic rep tie, he shone with authority. The attendees, largely sleep-deprived residents, made the effort to stop eating and pay attention.
"Show the video first, please," Dr. Finley called.
Carrie noticed a resident to her right spontaneously close his eyes with the dimming of the lights. The rigors of a residency program were universally brutal, and Carrie understood the fatigue. She hoped none of the VA residents would ever have to endure the nightmare she, and more importantly, Leon Dixon had suffered because of her own exhaustion.
"This gentleman, we'll call him Patient X."
With the start of Dr. Finley's lecture, Carrie cleared her troubled thoughts and focused on her new boss's narration.
"Patient X developed signs of Parkinson's disease in his early 40s. He had been exposed to Agent Orange while in Vietnam in his late teens."
The video was a series of home movies, a life well lived, but as the film soon revealed, one quickly diminished by the ravages of disease. The symptoms were a mirror of Don McCall's ailment. The footage went on to show the crippling nature of PD, frozen movement, violent tremors, spastic limbs. Dr. Finley reviewed the anatomy of the basal ganglia and its interconnections, structures deep in the brain that were affected in Parkinson's disease. Then he began to discuss the DBS treatments.
"We first stimulated the right ventral lateral nucleus of the thalamus. That benefited his left arm tremor, but not much more. That electrode has been removed, and 6 months ago we placed electrodes bilaterally in the globus pallidus interna. This next video shows his current status."
The audience, impartial before, was captivated by Patient X's freedom of movement. Had Carrie not witnessed Don McCall's dramatic improvement for herself, she would have had a hard time believing the footage.
"Deep brain stimulation is a form of stereotactic neurosurgery," Dr. Finley continued. "We insert electrodes guided by a stereotactic frame, as well as CT and MRI imaging, deep into brain nuclear complexes that are involved in complex movement patterns. Lights, please."
As the lights came on, some in the audience began rubbing their eyes. Dr. Finley removed his glasses.
The value of DBS has been proven in Parkinson's disease, but what's particularly exciting for us at the VA is that we're exploring the use of DBS as a new chapter in psychosurgery. We believe we are at the vanguard of hope in treating conditions that have defied the most comprehensive drug and counseling programs.
Dr. Finley smiled. Everyone was there to find out about the planned DBS program expansion. Sam Rockwell had done a number of procedures, but the pilot program had been operating in stealth mode. Dr. Finley said,
"As many of you are well aware, here at the VA, both outpatient and inpatient psychiatry have become overwhelmed by the number of PTSD cases."
For several minutes, Dr. Finley presented a sobering array of statistics.
1/3 of veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have contemplated suicide.
When he compared this to the 3.7% of the general adult population who had serious thoughts of suicide, the military stat looked stark. He coupled these statistics with the numbers of actual military suicides.
22 per day, by current estimates, which also far outpaces the rate from 15 years ago, Finley said. Long-term mental health care is perceived by many to be detrimental to military career advancement. Misguided as that is, it remains a fact. Close to 50% of servicemen and women suffering from PTSD will not seek treatment because of the stigma or, and I say this knowing who pays my salary, the challenges of navigating the VA's antiquated bureaucracy.
Dr. Finley paused until the chuckles died down.
An operation, I believe, would be far more attractive to those afflicted and thus would dramatically increase the numbers of those willing to be treated.
Dr. Finley fell silent to allow the notion to sink in.
It has been reported that the economic impact of PTSD, limited to just the military, is anywhere between $4 to $6 billion, and this does not take into account the spouses and children whose lives are further traumatized. I would argue that $4 billion grossly underestimates the economic toll.
Of course, Carrie thought of Adam. His lost wages and diminished potential, coupled with the burden on her parents emotionally, financially, and in scaled-back career plans for themselves. Her family was just a tiny fraction of that billion-dollar crisis. Dr. Finley showed a schematic of the limbic system, a complex network of structures ringing the ventricular system deep in the brain. Its functions were many, including regulation of emotion and basic drives and motivation. It also regulated the initial processing and emotional aspects of memories, and the body's response to stress, including blood pressure, pulse, and respiratory rate, as well as sleep patterns. Tiny as it was, the almond-shaped amygdala nucleus, located deep and medially in the temporal lobe, was accountable for a whole host of critical functions.
We believe the basolateral nucleus of the amygdala represents the most promising target for DBS in treating PTSD. Here is where fear and its memory converge.
Dr. Finley advanced the slide. The amygdala was now circled in red.
This is the epicenter, where our primitive fight-or-flight reactions form in response to a threat, where unchecked rage can be unleashed in response to a disturbing memory. Regardless of how much we try to alleviate these terrible memories through therapy or pharmaceuticals, we know that PTSD symptoms are structurally embedded, literally imprinted in the brain. And we believe this processing involves the amygdala nucleus significantly.
Dr. Finley came out from behind the lectern. He made eye contact with Carrie, and she smiled.
We have realized something that you may find counterintuitive. Traditionally, the goal of treatment has been focused on the mitigation of disturbing thoughts and memories, analogous to the way we treat many phobias. Think of the man who is afraid of heights, for example. We may subject him to systematic desensitization by gradually introducing him to higher heights. And indeed, such treatment is often effective, at least partially, for phobias. But war zone trauma is something else entirely. We are discovering in controlled laboratory experiments that electroshock therapy administered to animals in close proximity to a traumatic event greatly suppresses those animals' behavioral response when immediately re-exposed to the trauma. In other words, they seem to have forgotten their emotional response to the initial trauma.
Dr. Finley went on to discuss a group of human test subjects who were involved in a different memory experiment involving electroshock therapy, more commonly known as ECT. These patients were first shown images of terribly unpleasant events and asked to recall them. Surprisingly, the researchers found that the patients were not able to remember any details of the disturbing event the day following their ECT, even though they had been told explicitly to remember the event in as much detail as possible. The shock treatment seemed to interfere with storing a new memory in the brain. The researchers concluded that there was a period of time when stored memories were accessed in which they could be vulnerable to manipulation. They could be modified, changed in some way, reconfigured, or reconsolidated. Dr. Finley continued,
"We know the intense connections of memory tied to emotions sends the amygdala into overdrive in PTSD. If we can dampen that hyperactivity in the amygdala, all the social and psychological consequences we see in PTSD, the nightmares, depression and apathy, anxiety and fear, the likely drift into drug and alcohol abuse, the emotional roller coaster, potential flashes of aggression, all this can potentially be negated."
Dr. Finley went on to present a series of slides referring more specifically to the anatomy of the amygdala and its connections to other limbic structures.
"Our goal is not to erase the memory, per se, but to erase the emotion associated with the memory. Let me repeat, the goal of our DBS program is emotional erasure. To do this, we first need to reproduce the soldier's trauma as vividly as possible. And just then, after the memory has been reproduced, we suppress the amygdala by deep brain stimulation of the amygdala's basolateral nucleus, interrupting its emotional and physiological connections to that memory, and in so doing, reconsolidate the memory without the emotional context."
A hand shot up from one of the psychiatric social workers seated directly behind Carrie. "How would you do that? How would you plan to recreate these memories so vividly?" Dr. Finley's expression brightened as if this question had been planted and anticipated.
"Glad you asked, Wanda. Today I am officially announcing a very exciting pilot program, initiated with the assistance of DARPA."
Dr. Finley's gaze traveled to the back of the room where the two men in suits were seated. Carrie guessed they were from the government.
"By a show of hands, how many of you have heard of DARPA?"
Fewer than half the hands in the room went up. One person felt the need to clarify. The initials, yes, but I'm not sure what it stands for." Dr. Finley gave a slight nod.
"It stands for Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Their mission is to create breakthrough technologies for national security. They're the folks who gave us the internet. Sorry, Al Gore."
The reference inspired scattered laughter. Dr. Finley continued.
"PTSD is approaching epidemic levels in the military. So DARPA has been experimenting with exposure therapy using virtual reality simulations."
Carrie felt a jolt. DARPA was remaking the war in pixels.
"We can recreate that IED event when a soldier's buddies were killed or maimed."
Dr. Finley spoke to a hushed audience.
"And while the brain is forcibly agitated, we have an opportunity to treat that individual with deep brain stimulation with the hope that we will actually erase the emotion associated with those terrible memories forever. I'm not talking suppressed. I'm talking gone forever. Ladies and gentlemen, I am pleased to see Calvin Trent from DARPA has joined us today. Cal, could you please stand up?"
Cal, the man with atlas shoulders and cold eyes, glanced briefly at his companion and stood up slowly. He acknowledged the audience, then sat right back down. Dr. Finley either did not recognize or did not know the other suit that had accompanied Cal Trent. Either way, the bald guy with a round face and beady eyes got no introduction. Dr. Finley said,
"Cal oversees all aspects of the program, including the virtual reality simulation, which is used prior to the DBS surgery to reconsolidate the negative memory. The virtual reality does leave many patients highly agitated, but that's a temporary state. We need the emotion heightened, the negative memory fresh, as close to surgery as possible. Once the electrical stimulation commences, the emotion gets dampened. It's as simple as that. Cal's pulled together an amazing team of people to run this program, and I know you'll extend him your every courtesy."
Carrie could sense excitement building in the audience. Just about everyone there had had some contact with a returning soldier who was devastated by PTSD, or his or her family. She thought again, always, of Adam. It had been eye-opening to live with her brother and see the difficulties he and her parents had been enduring.